From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
It seems the former president of the University of Florida wasn't exactly thrifty when it came to his office spending.
With salary expenses, they doubled from about $3 million, $3.5 million to $7 million, if I remember correctly.
Also this week, a big administrative shakeup is underway at Florida A&M University as an interim president takes over. Among those who've packed their bags,
the athletics director, a communications director, a chief legal officer for his board of trustees, and the government relations director.
We'll also see how the fight for Florida's largest state Senate district is shaping up, and we'll find that Florida's new restrictive abortion law is prompting an increasing amount of out-of-state travel. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Problems at two of Florida's universities lead off this week's Capitol Report. Former University of Florida President Ben Sasse tripled presidential office spending, according to the Independent Florida Alligator, a student-run newspaper. The story is based on a side-by-side financial comparison with previous UF President Kent Fox. Fox kept a staff of less than 10 people. Sasse tripled that, making hires related to his previous job as a Nebraska U.S. Senator. He also hired a consulting firm that he previously worked for. WUFT's Matthew Capelli spoke with the reporter who broke the story, Gareth Shanley.
How much money did his presidency cost?
Well, you can get a total tally of what his office's expenses were, but I don't think it would be fair to report the raw number without a standard. So we had to set out to find what his successor, President Fox, spent. And the macro number was, in Fox's last year, he spent $5.65 million in total president's office expenses, and in Sasse's first full year, he spent $17.3.
My impression from reading your article is that most of that was in the presidential appointments in different positions that he added in his office. Is that correct?
So salary expenses, they doubled from about $3.5 million to $7 million, if I remember correctly. A lot of that was accounted for by him hiring ex-Senate staff and former Republican officials. And then a large chunk of it was an increase in contractual services, a lot of which was driven by consulting contracts.
Do you have any sense about if, you know, this expanded office of 30 is going to stay as is?
We have no confirmation from the university yet on whether or not there were changes in the president's office staff. A Tennessee publication did report that Penny Schwinn, who is the vice president of PK-12 and pre-bachelor's programs that Sasse hired, had stepped down or was no longer at the university following Sasse's resignation, and she's not listed as a member of the president's cabinet on the website anymore. One aspect of the reporting that has kind of vexed me since we first reported on it last August was the McKinsey contract. The firm is somewhat notoriously secretive about their work and typically shield it from public view using public records laws protecting trade secrets. So they redacted a scope of work attachment which would outline what their responsibilities would be to the university. And any requests to the university or through public records have produced no answers.
How much money did McKinsey receive from the university?
$4.7 million was the initial number in the contract.
Something that I found particularly interesting was like the vow of political celibacy Sasse took when he came to office. How do you understand that?
That was following student protests over his history as a Nebraska Republican senator. So I think his response to that was to vow political celibacy. He would leave behind partisan politics, wouldn't engage in any political activities. But I think the public should know if he was hiring, you know, ex-staff from the U.S. Senate and former Republican officials and let them decide whether or not that breached that vow.
That was Gareth Shanley of the Independent Florida Alligator. Shanley uncovered considerable spending by former UF President Ben Sasse compared to previous university leadership. Sasse left the presidency last month after less than 2 years. He said he needed to focus on his wife's health. and would stay on as a professor. On Capitol Report, it seems the University of Florida is not the only major school in the state that is having its share of challenges at the moment. Florida A&M University, the state's preeminent HBCU located in Tallahassee, the state capital, has also had more than its share of, shall we say, interesting developments in the past several months. And Adrian Andrews joins us to talk about that. We know President Robinson has left as the head guy at the school, Adrian. We have an interim president now, and apparently that is not the only personnel change that's going on over there. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, that's correct, Tom. Interim President Timothy Beard, he recently sent out a sort of a group email, as you speak, right? He sent out a group email to a list of senior leadership staff. And actually, I have this list here. That includes an athletics director, a communications director, a chief legal officer for his board of trustees, and the government relations director. So all of which who have been released from their positions. This means that, yeah, it's a big shakeup that's happening at the university, a few administrative changes, and that's actually part of Timothy Beard's 100-day strategic plan to move the university forward.
They say timing is everything, Adrian, but this kicks off a brand new semester over at FAMU and indeed across the entire state. What does that do operationally to Florida A&M as they get that new semester underway?
Yeah, that's a good point, Tom. And really, that was a huge concern for faculty and staff. They just recently held a faculty meeting. And the biggest thing we're speaking of was just salaries. What are we going to do with salaries? What are we going to do to fill these positions? Are they going to be in some type of large search firm or, getting these guys in and filling these roles? And what Beard said is quite interesting. He doesn't have a time or estimated time on when he's going to get some replacements in, but he says when he does, he's going to be looking for people who's going to look for, who's going to look at licensure pass rates, get those test scores up, work on academics. Also, he's going to address some teacher salaries and professor salaries. So right now they are without a lot of people. So that's definitely going to be sort of a issue for FAMU. But again, Beard has said he's going to address that when the time comes.
And of course, there will be most likely a nationwide search for a new permanent president of Florida A&M at some point, I would think.
That's correct. They're looking to have someone named by next July. And so what that comes is the board of trustees is going to get together. They're going to kick off that national search team and try to figure out who's the best candidate. Now, Beard cannot be one of those people who go and apply for the job. He has to be actually appointed to that position if he was to accept it. But as of right now, they're looking at next summer.
Sturm und Drang over at Florida A&M University, as well as down at the University of Florida. Adrian Andrews, thanks for joining us on Capitol Report.
No problem. Thank you, Tom.
Coming up on Capitol Report, a Florida ban on what's known as cultivated meat is being challenged in court.
We're not looking to replace conventional meat, which will always have a place on our tables. We want to give consumers a choice.
The battle for Florida State Senate District 3 has become more than a little bit interesting.
It is the only competitive Senate race in the state of Florida this cycle.
Florida's stricter abortion law is prompting ever more amounts of out-of-state travel. And there's often a reason why college and university students have to wait a while until landlords repair the property damage from the previous student renters. A California-based producer of lab-grown poultry has filed a federal challenge to a new Florida ban on selling or manufacturing cultivated meat. The manufacturing process includes taking a small number of cultured cells from animals and growing them in controlled settings to make food. Lawmakers approved the ban this year. Upside Foods contends the law violates a constitutional prohibition on favoring in-state businesses over out-of-state competitors. Company founder Uma Valetti says Florida is the first state to enact such a ban.
To be clear, we're not looking to replace conventional meat, which will always have a place on our tables. We want to give consumers a choice so they can eat cultivated meat or conventional meat.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill in rural Hardy County in May with members of the cattle industry on hand.
In the state of Florida, we've put down the marker very clearly. We stand with agriculture. We stand with the cattle ranchers. We stand with our farmers because we understand it's important for the backbone of the state. It's important for our culture. It's important for our heritage.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture last year approved Upside Foods to manufacture and sell its products. The race for Florida's 3rd Senate District is shaping up to be the most expensive state election race this election cycle. Tristan Wood reports political watchers are saying its results could have sweeping political ramifications in Tallahassee.
Darrell Parks, a civil rights attorney and frontrunner of the Democratic primary in the seat, has been coming right at incumbent Republican Senator Corey Simon in campaign ads.
Simon supports banning abortion. Simon took $250,000 from insurance company, then voted to let him jack up our bills. You can't hide your record behind lies, Corey. The truth is, you're the problem.
Meanwhile, Simon has been running his own attack ads against Parks.
Darrell Parks won't sell off this problem. He is the problem.
Parks has also raised a significant amount of money to take on Simon, over $800,000. Still, Simon has about double that, bringing in more than $1.5 million. Both have most of that money left to spend, and have begun buying digital and television ads across the district. Evan Power, chair of the Republican Party of Florida, says North Florida residents can expect to keep seeing those ads till November.
It is the only competitive Senate race in the state of Florida this cycle, and you know the Tallahassee media market's a little cheaper than some of the places where these wars usually exist, so they have a lot of money to spend and not a lot to get on TV.
Simon etched out a victory in the Democratic-leaning district in 2022, an election year where Democratic turnout was abysmally low across the state. Ryan Ray, chair of the Leon County Democratic Party, says Parks has a strong reputation and can knock off Simon.
Corey Simon has allowed extremist Republicans in the state Senate to abridge public comment, to limit amendments that are being offered by members, and they have over and over again run roughshod over our community right here in Tallahassee. Flipping that seat from red to blue will bring a resolution to that that's in keeping with the values of not just Democrats, but everybody of good faith here in North Florida.
Power says yes, the seat is Democratic-leaning in makeup, but he points out that Republicans would still control a supermajority in the Senate if Parks won. Regardless, he says he is confident that Simon can hold on to it.
He's delivered for the small counties and delivered for Tallahassee in ways that a Democrat has not been able to, in appropriations and passing laws. And I think people look at that and see that the failed trend of electing Democrats time and time again doesn't work for them. So they're going to return Corey Simon back to the Senate to keep delivering for the district rather than play politics on a state level.
UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett does believe Democrats have a strong chance at flipping the seat. He sees it being a presidential year as a significant force to boost Democratic turnout. Yet he is not writing Simon off.
And incumbents usually have an advantage. They can, you know, it's easier raising money. His name recognition was already solid, but it's even stronger now after 2 years in the Florida Senate. And he'll, of course, have a huge amount of support from outside groups and from other Republicans who will, you know, campaign with him and for him. So, you know, all that to say, Parks has got his work cut out for him.
The seat will be decided during the November 5th election. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida Senate President Kathleen Passidomo today ruled out a special legislative session to address problems facing condominium associations and owners, which includes soaring costs. In a memorandum to senators, Pasadomo said condominium laws can be addressed during committee meetings after the November elections and during the 2025 regular session. She pointed to what she described as misconceptions and inaccuracies about condominium laws passed after the 2021 collapse of the Champlain Towers South Building in Surfside that killed 98 people. Last month, Governor Ron DeSantis said it was up to the legislature to address significant increases in assessments that residents face on top of homeowners association fees. Pasadomo's stance mirrored a statement from incoming Senate President Ben Albritton, Republican of Wachula, that committee weeks and the regular session, which starts on March 4th, would be the time to address the issues. Albritton will succeed Pasadomo as president after the November elections. Abortions are declining in Florida since a six-week ban went into effect in May. The state releases monthly updates to the year's abortion totals, and the last couple have been much lower. Now, WUSF's Stephanie Colombini reports many people are traveling out of state for care.
Amber Pugh got a recent call from a woman who was crying and desperate. Pugh works for the National Abortion Hotline and helps Floridians access abortion care.
She shared with me that the partner involved with the pregnancy was refusing to assist her. She's already struggling to provide for her two children. She can't afford another child at this time because she's already behind on her rent payments.
This woman was nearly 6 weeks pregnant, and Pugh says she wasn't going to have time to get a legal abortion in Florida. Pugh eventually helped her find care elsewhere, but with most of the Southeast under abortion bans too, she had to go hundreds of miles to Washington, D.C.
It's been incredibly difficult to watch care be decimated to this point in Florida.
The number of people the hotline helped travel out of Florida for care exploded by nearly 600% in the months after the six-week ban went into effect. That's compared to the same time last year, when abortion was still available until 15 weeks of pregnancy. Southerners and states with stricter bans were also coming to Florida for care then. Now, Floridians and others are turning to places like D.C., Virginia, and Illinois.
We certainly have seen a significant increase already.
Dr. Allison Cowett is an OBGYN in Chicago. Her clinic is seeing twice as many abortion patients from Florida and nearby states as they were before. Patients may have to get time off work or arrange childcare. Cowett says some tell her they've never been to a big city like Chicago. Others have never flown on a plane.
We are taking care of these people who are traveling for, you know, already a stressful situation, wanting to exercise their right to abortion and needing support and care and really being more traumatized by having to travel these long distances.
Cowett says abortion funds are helping many of these patients plan and pay for their trips. But even with financial help, not everyone can drop everything and travel to get an abortion right away. Chelsea Souter owns Hope Clinic in Southern Illinois and has also seen a huge spike in patients from the Southeast.
The further that people have to travel, the more likely people are getting pushed further in pregnancy. And what we've seen at Hope since the Dobbs decision is that folks who are trying to access abortion in the second trimester has increased 2.5-fold.
That drives up abortion costs and can put the patient at higher risk for complications. Pregnant women have a legal right to travel to places with fewer abortion restrictions, says John Stemberger. He's with the Liberty Council, a group that opposes abortion. He wants women to pursue parenthood or adoption instead.
It's not just about changing the law. It's about changing the hearts and minds of people. And when a pregnant woman who doesn't have resources or is scared or is abortion-minded, that she thinks differently and there's resources there to support that woman, especially if finances are the issue.
Stemberger points to state funding for pregnancy centers and things like formula and diapers as examples. Abortion rights advocates argue carrying a pregnancy to term isn't an option for some people. Travel isn't the only way Floridians are working around the state's ban. There's been a nationwide surge in people getting abortion medications through the mail. Medical professionals and places without abortion bans prescribe the pills online, and patients take them at home. Chicago doctor Allison Cowett says it can be safe and effective.
So we're hoping people will, you know, get the appropriate instructions and medication from a reputable source, whether it's through telemedicine or several of the online medication abortion providers that have popped up.
It's illegal in Florida to use telehealth or mail pills for abortions, though the bans apply to doctors, not pregnant women. Still, the pills are only approved for use in the first 10 weeks of pregnancy. Abortion access in Florida could change again if voters choose to protect it in the state's constitution. Amendment 4 is on the November ballot and needs 60% approval to pass. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Tampa.
Florida's insurer of last resort offers premiums that cost much less than private insurers. The gap between what Citizens Property Insurance charges property owners and what other companies charge has gotten wider as the cost of regular homeowners insurance has skyrocketed. Citizens has over 1.2 million policies, making it by far the largest carrier in the state. WLRN's Tom Hudson has that story.
As the state-backed home insurance company, the insurance premiums charged by Citizens are not meant to be competitive with other insurance companies. And they're not, by a lot.
You know, in this case, you can see that what jumps out here, increase needed to be non-competitive. To get to
this is Brian Donovan. He's the chief actuary at Citizens.
The premiums would have to be increased by 96.8%. So basically doubled, close to double, to get it to what we consider non-competitive.
That's how much Citizens would have to hike its average premium for regular homeowners insurance in 2025 to bring its premium closer to the average premium from private insurance companies. Last year, Citizens was about 44% below many other insurers. Donovan was speaking earlier this month at the company's rate increase hearing before the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation. Now, he was quick to point out Citizens is not asking for its average insurance rates to double.
Obviously, you know, we're not proposing that once again. We know the glide path exists.
The glide path is the maximum amount Citizens can increase its premiums as prescribed by state law. The idea is to glide Citizens' premiums up and closer to the competitive rates. Slowly. Very slowly.
Our rates remain, for the most part, actuarially unsound and highly competitive around the state. And as a governmental insurer of last resort, we should never be competing with the private market.
Tim Cirio is the Citizens CEO.
Being less competitive is simply the only way to reduce Citizens' size. A smaller Citizens is needed, of course, to prevent assessments on Floridians.
If Citizens gets into financial trouble, it can charge a fee to Florida taxpayers. The company wants to boost its rates 14% beginning in January. That's the maximum allowed under state law, and that's after a 13% increase this year. But the premium increases in the private market have far exceeded this, further widening the gap between what Citizens charges and what other insurance companies charge.
There is no competition in Monroe County. Citizens is our insurer of last resort, and so they're not competing with anyone here.
This is Caroline Horn with Fair Insurance Rates in Monroe. It advocates for home insurance in the Keys. Citizens is the only insurer for hurricane protection in the Keys.
And I think that what we'd like right now is no increase.
Citizens wants to hike its regular homeowners insurance 16% in the Keys and a little bit less in the rest of South Florida. It wants to increase its hurricane insurance by about 14.5%. A final decision by state regulators is due later this month. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
Unemployment in Florida held steady at 3.3% in July, while retirements among baby boomers and some Gen Xers are affecting the state's labor force. Numbers released today by the Florida Department of Commerce show the same unemployment rate as in April, May, and June. The size of the labor force was down slightly in July, while the number of people out of work ticked up. Jimmy Heckman, the department's chief economist, attributes the labor force trends to Florida having an aging population with people making permanent exits from the workforce.
Retirements are making up more and more of those share of the population. We're not really seeing any other noticeable changes and any other reasons that people might, you know, not participate in the labor force.
The state's labor force in July totaled just over 11 million people. That was down 12,000 from June. Meanwhile, the state had 366,000 people qualified as out of work in July. That was an increase of 5,000 from June. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, many college students are now in a period they call Homeless Week. It can actually be longer than a week. It's that gap of time near the end of the summer session and the start of the fall semester. It's stressful, and it's not going away anytime soon, as WUFT's Anya Pinello reports from Gainesville.
August Mallows is trying to squeeze everything he owns into his car.
There's stuff all over, stuff from every part of your life.
There's a vacuum cleaner, kitchen utensils, a whiteboard.
Oh, and a memory foam mattress. Those are tough to pack because they expand. They're very greedy for space.
Mallows is a senior at the University of Florida. Every year, students like him who stick around for the summer have to move out of their apartments mid-semester. Property managers come in, clean up the place, and get everything ready for the start of the fall semester when all of the students come back. But it leaves summer students without a place to stay. And we're not talking about a long weekend. This is for a good week or two.
Leaves a lot of people without an option for a roof over their head, essentially.
The choices are limited. A friend's couch, their parents' house, maybe an Airbnb or a hotel, if they can afford it. Mallows is staying with friends and family.
But if I didn't have that option, I would have had to live in my car. I would have had to sleep next to my mattress somewhere, like a Walmart parking lot. I'm not even really sure.
This has been happening in college towns across the U.S. for years, and Gainesville is no exception. Because there are so many students here, it's easier for property managers to set aside a full-on cleaning period than it is to coordinate move-outs with each student. And because the rental market here revolves around the school year, they need to get these properties cleaned out now. April Strickland is the owner and broker of Golden Rule Real Estate. She says the amount of work involved in turning these homes around is epic. In fact, the industry has a name for it, Turn Week.
Depending on what has to be done, we will have painters work through the night. I've worked through the night. I have slept on my office floor a number of nights before.
Strickland does a walkthrough of a house that was rented out by two college students. She estimates it's one of 10,000 properties in Gainesville that'll have to get fully cleaned in just 2 weeks. And this one, it's not in the best of shape. There are tiny dead bugs in the freezer, the hallway door has fallen off its hinges, and it smells like pee.
So essentially what I'm seeing is yellow staining down the entire baseboard where urine has dripped down the wall, down to the baseboards, onto the carpet, and it's actually eaten away the paint in some areas because urine's very acidic.
Not all the homes are this bad, Strickland says, but it's still tough. She has her own name for it, Turnpocalypse.
I would love to figure out a way that we don't have to do all this in a mad dash because it is hard. It is punishing. It is brutal at times.
Strickland guesses it'll take at least 7 days to get this house fully cleaned. She says there's just no way to do it without this cleaning period. While that may be understandable to some, it's little consolation for students like Emma Forrester.
Basically, the lease ends on July 28th, but we still have classes till August 9th. So basically,
she's a junior at UF. When I spoke to her in July, I found her studying, packing, and getting ready for finals. For homeless week, she considered sleeping in her car, but her parents talked her out of it. Instead, she'll be staying at a friend's house with three other people who are all going through the same thing.
It's very stressful to like move all your stuff out and like find a place, and then like be living with all these people. Like your like routines get like mixed up, and it's just, yeah, it's a lot.
But she's trying to look on the bright side. She tells herself she can make it. It's just 2 weeks, even if it means students like her might have to do it all over again next year.
That was WUFT's Anya Pinello reporting. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Matthew Capelli, Stephanie Colombini, Tom Hudson, and Anya Pinello. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.